Tonight's reading is taken from the book of Isaiah, chapter 6, verse 1 to 8. Isaiah's vision of the Lord. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with the two he flew. And one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the thresholds shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, "Behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away, and your sin atoned for." And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?" Then I said, "Here am I, send me."
Thank you, Kenny, very much. Just let me try and get this fan working. A very warm welcome to you, especially if you're here for the first time, and a special welcome to, there are a few pastors visiting from Kassel in Germany, so if that's you, a very big Guten Abend from the barge. And you'll find inside your service sheet this little white thing headed the cross. So today we're beginning a short series looking at the cross. And today our topic is, why do we need the cross? Well, Sir Patrick Moore, the famous British astronomer and broadcaster, presented the BBC programme Sky at Night for over 50 years. And the title of his autobiography is 80 Not Out. But last December, his long innings did actually come to an end, and he died at the age of 89. Now, I don't know whether in the end he did actually do this, but in that book, he gives details of arrangements that he had made for a final party to be held at his house after his death. And at the party, he wanted a tape to be played, which he had recorded. And this is how the tape ends. "I won't be seeing you for a bit, but in the long run, you will join me. I assure you that as soon as you have rung the bell at the pearly gates and signed in, I'll be there to meet you. I will at once escort you to the nearest bar and treat you to a stiff nectar and soda. Be seeing you. All the best, Patrick." There was a man who was utterly confident that heaven was where he was heading and utterly confident that God would accept him. And yet elsewhere in that book, he is pretty dismissive of Jesus. He had little time for the Bible's message about Jesus, and the death of Jesus just didn't figure in his thinking. It's a common enough attitude, isn't it? So many people who've got little time for Jesus, they assume that when they die, they're going to go to a better place, and God will accept them, and they're good enough as they are. But that is completely at odds with what the Bible teaches. The central message of the Bible is the good news about Jesus, the gospel. And at the heart of the gospel is the death of Jesus Christ on a cross. And trusting in the cross, in Jesus' death for us, is the only way, the Bible says, for us to be right with God. But the question is, why is that? Why do we need the cross? So why is that the only way? You know, assuming I'm not a paedophile or a rapist, you know, why can't God just accept me as I am? Why does he have a problem with that? Well, that's the issue we're focusing on today as we begin this series on the cross. Why do we need the cross? Now, obviously, that is an important question to consider if at the moment you don't yet trust in Jesus' death for you. But even if you do, it's a very good question to revisit. Because the danger is that even as Christians, there will be a tendency for us to drift away from the cross. Perhaps you're aware of that having happened. You know, maybe you can remember a time in your life when the cross was really central, but now you've drifted away from that. And you're just not relying on God's grace day by day as you once did. Perhaps you felt, you know, well, I needed it back then in the early days as a Christian, but, you know, now with my track record of pursuing godliness and being active in service, you know, now I feel I make the grade as I am. You know, you've improved. You've sorted your act out. Your Christian CV is pretty impressive now. Why do we need the cross today just as much as we ever did? Well, we find the answer here in Isaiah 6. The prophet Isaiah was speaking to people who thought they didn't need God's grace. They thought they were okay as they were. But then here in chapter 6, they come face to face with reality. The reality of what God is like and the reality of what we are like. And those two things are things we need to get into focus too. What is God really like and what am I really like? And the two go together. So only when I see what God is really like will I actually see clearly what I am really like. And then, and only then, will I see clearly my need of God's grace. So firstly then, a big vision of God. If you've got the passage open, it says in chapter 6, verse 1, "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple." Uzziah, not to be confused with Isaiah, but Uzziah the king had come to the throne as a 16-year-old, and he had had a long and a prosperous reign. He was king of Judah for over 50 years. And he was famous, his fame spread far and wide. But, and we read this in 2 Chronicles 26:16, I put the references at the bottom. It says, "But when he was strong, he grew proud to his destruction, for he was unfaithful to the Lord his God." In judgment, God struck him down with leprosy. And he spent the final years of his life in isolation. And in 740 BC, he died a leper. "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up." Isaiah was given this vision of the King, the true King, the King of Kings, in his majesty and holiness. Isaiah says, "I saw the Lord." But actually, the Lord himself isn't described in this vision, is he? Instead, we see thrones, and we see his throne, we see robes, we see attendants. But the impression this scene makes is one of majesty. "I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up." As I must have felt like this little ant who was gazing up at this throne that was towering above him. The Lord seated on it, high and lifted up. So in the seat of all authority, all power in the universe. When we get to Isaiah 57, verse 15, it says this, "Thus says the one who is high and lifted up," same little pair, "who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy, I dwell in the high and holy place." And it goes on here, "The train of his robe filled the temple." So even just the back part of his royal robes filled the whole temple. And verse 2 says, "Above him stood the seraphim." Literally, the seraphim means the burning ones. So these were fiery heavenly creatures who were waiting on their seated master, ready to do his bidding. "Above him stood the seraphim. Each had 6 wings. With 2 he covered his face." So even these heavenly creatures, they couldn't look at God, but they had to cover their faces from his awesome majesty, I guess a bit like us looking at the blazing direct sunlight. You can't look straight at it. So with 2, they covered their faces. With 2, he covered his feet. Maybe that signifies they would only go where God wanted them to go. And with 2, he flew. Remember some years ago, I had a meeting with Stephen Green when he was the head of HSBC. And I remember getting to the ground floor reception where it's all hustle and bustle and activity and people coming and going and noise and so on. But you get in the lift and then you speed up to floor 42, I think it was, and you speed past all these open office plan floors with, you know, hustle and bustle and trading floors and noise and you name it. And then you get up to floor 42 and there's a little ping and the doors open from the lift and you step out and it is just completely quiet. You can hear a pin drop. There's not a noise. There's no one around at all, apart from this huge, great reception desk and this little woman sitting there. And then apart from that, there's just this door with Stephen Green's name on it. And I just sort of sat there waiting in the eerie silence. And then suddenly, at last, this door with his name on opened. And there before me was this little man who said, "Hello, how are you doing? And come in and take a seat." And it was all a bit, you know, of an anticlimax. It was an ordinary bloke. You know, he's a bloke with a better view from his office than most people, I suppose, below, but just an ordinary bloke. It's different with God. If you'd been with Isaiah, as the door of the temple opened and you went in, your reaction would have been more sort of, wow, as you looked up and you saw the King on his throne, towering above you. Would have been breathtaking, would have been jaw-dropping. Wow. I've not been there. Maybe it's a bit like being on the edge of the Grand Canyon. You've been to the Grand Canyon, sort of just trying to take in what is before you. Or a situation I have been in, sitting in a tiny kayak in Sweden as this massive ocean liner goes past you within a few metres of you heading off to Finland or wherever. But to majesty is added holiness. That's the second thing. So verse 3 says, and one, this is a seraphim, one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." Now this word holy comes from a root word meaning to cut off or to separate. So that God is holy means that he is cut off, he is separate from us. He's distinct from us. And he's distinct from us in two ways. Firstly, he is distinct from us in that God is transcendent. Transcendent is a big word which basically means that God stands apart from all others and all creation in greatness. He is so great that he stands apart from the whole creation. As he says himself in Isaiah 40, verse 25, "To whom then will you compare me that I should be like him?" God is incomparable. So God's holiness means he's set apart, he's incomparable in greatness. He alone is the creator, everything else is created. But secondly, God's holiness speaks of God's righteousness. So that God is distinct from us, not just in being great, but also in being without sin, pure, spotless, perfect, just, righteous. So ethically speaking, morally speaking, God is purer than pure. He is white-hot purity. And notice it says here to emphasize that he isn't just holy, and he's not even just holy, holy, but he's holy, holy, holy. He's the essence of holiness. So in Hebrew, one way that you express a superlative, that is to say, the highest degree of something, is by repeating the word. So for example, Genesis 14:10, it says in our translations that the valley was full of pits. But if you look it up in the Hebrew says, pits, pits, because that's how they say it, so full of pits, 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 you repeat the word. Or if you look up 2 Kings 25:15, our translation says pure gold. But if you look up the Hebrew, it says, what do you think it says? Gold, gold. Okay, great, you're awake. That's wonderful. But here the seraphim have to invent this sort of super superlative for God to express how completely and utterly holy he is. He is holy, holy, holy. As the prophet Habakkuk says, "You are of purer eyes than to see evil, and you cannot look at wrong." Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. And hosts probably means there the whole of creation. He's the Lord, he's the ruler of everything. The whole earth is full of his glory. And verse 4 goes on, "The foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke." So powerful is the voice of even just one of these seraphim who is calling, who waits on God, that the foundations of the temple are shaken. So his voice booming out, it would have felt to Isaiah as if the whole temple structure was going to come down on top of him, and it was about to collapse. And it says that smoke filled the whole place, the temple. Smoke signified the presence of God. And as the saying goes, there is no smoke without fire. And if you were with us in the Hebrew series, we learned that God, our God, is a consuming fire. It's a very scary, terrifying for Isaiah. What is God like? How does our vision of God compare? Do you have a picture in your mind of God and of what God is like? Do you have a picture, an idea of what it might be like to stand before God? How does it compare to this, to Isaiah's experience in this vision? In Isaiah 50, verse 21, God says, "You thought that I was one like yourself." You thought that I was one like yourself. And perhaps we do. Maybe we think of God as someone who is not so very different to us, except that he's in heaven and we're on earth. Well, people say, don't they, "I like to think of God as," and then they play the blankety-blank game and fill it in as they see fit. But this is what God is really like, the God who is there. He's awesome in majesty and holiness, high and lifted up, seated on the throne of the universe. Some years back, the artist Tracy Emin designed a statue for the city of Liverpool. And it was a little bird on a 13-foot pole. And she explained that, she said, most public sculptures are a symbol of power, which I find oppressive and dark. And she said that she wanted something which would appear and disappear and not dominate. Is that not exactly what people have done with God? God of awesome power and majesty and holiness is rather threatening. Much more manageable to have this tiny bird on a pole. Doesn't dominate, in fact you hardly notice him. You know, a mini god, pocket god, pygmy god, a sort of bird on a pole god. And not so very different to me, God. But the God Isaiah saw is the God who is actually there. What would it be like meeting him? What would it be like coming face to face with this God who is actually there? Well, verse 5, Isaiah said, "Woe is me, for I am lost. For I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." That is how it feels to be in the presence of this God who is actually there. Not just wow, but woe. Woe is me. You see, Isaiah wasn't just awed by the scene. It wasn't just the wow of standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon. It was the woe of being terrified. Woe is me. I'm lost, or perhaps better, I'm ruined. Or we might say, I'm stuffed. You know, there's no hope for me. Why did Isaiah feel like that? Well, because he knew that he wasn't just small in the presence of greatness, but he was a sinner in the presence of awesome holiness and purity. "Woe is me," he says, "for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips." It's interesting, isn't it? Why does he single out his lips in particular? Perhaps because he, hearing the seraphim calling to one another, maybe he realized that he was too sinful to join in, couldn't take part. Chatting to Andrew about this beforehand, he come across an idea that maybe it was because, as the prophet, his lips were sort of his most redeeming features, his best thing. You know, words was his job. And yet even this bit of him was corrupt. Maybe it was because he knew that our lips reveal what's in our hearts. You know, the idea that the mouth is the overflow of the heart. Whatever it is, it was seeing God in his white-hot purity and sinlessness that made Isaiah aware of how dirty and sinful he himself was. He felt exposed. Here he was standing before the holy God, knowing that this God in front of him knew his every word and thought and action. He knew that the God in front of him could see what was in his heart. So he as a person was a bit like one of these bags on at the airport going through the x-ray machine. It's all there. You can see what's inside. So all the stuff that, you remember what Jesus said was in our hearts in Mark 7. He said, "From within, out of the heart of man, come." Do you remember that long list? Evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within and they make a person unclean, Jesus said. King Uzziah, you remember I said he was struck down with leprosy. According to the law, so in Leviticus 13, he would have had to have cried out, "Unclean, unclean," and covered his top lip as he walked around. That's what lepers had to do. And Isaiah, the prophet, now realized that he himself was no different. Morally speaking, he was no different. He was unclean as well. And what opened his eyes to that was seeing God as he really is. I don't know if you've come across the book, The Water Babies, by Charles Kingsley. But in that book, there's a boy called Tom, who is a chimney sweep. So this is set back in 19th century. One day in this huge mansion, Tom, the chimney sweep, loses his way. And crawling through this maze of flues and chimneys. And instead of crawling out down the kitchen chimney, as he's supposed to do, he crawls out onto the hearth in this spotlessly white room, where there's this lovely little girl who is lying asleep between immaculately white sheets, in a room where there's not a speck of dirt to be seen anywhere. And Tom, the little orphan chimney sweep, he gazed around him, enchanted by this first sight of such beauty and cleanness, and he'd never imagined that something so spotless and lovely could exist. And suddenly he caught sight of a filthy, ape-like little creature, sooty black from head to foot, standing on the rose-pink carpet, with pools of black perspiration dripping from its body. And such an object was so shockingly out of place in these surroundings that he shook his fist in return. And he shouted furiously, "Get out of here at once!" But the black ape shook its fist in return. And suddenly, for the first time in his life, poor little Tom realized that he was looking in a mirror and he was seeing himself as he really was. And it broke his heart. And uttering a desolate and despairing cry, he rushed out of the house, sobbing as he went, saying, "I must be clean. I must be clean. Where can I find streams of water and wash and be clean?" Seeing God in his holiness is a little bit like being dropped down into that spotless white room. We suddenly see ourselves as we really are. We look in the mirror and we see this filthy chimney sweep, so out of place in such spotless surroundings, and we feel ashamed, and we feel condemned, and we should feel afraid. Woe is me, for I am lost. I'm ruined. In our worst moments, we quite like our sin, don't we? We indulge it, we excuse it, we don't want to let go of it. But God's holiness means he hates sin. He really hates it. It arouses his righteous anger. And he's got to deal with it. He's got to judge it. Now, if you're a sinner, that is a terrifying prospect, isn't it? To be before that sort of holy God. A few chapters before in Isaiah, in chapter 2, verse 19, the prophet looks ahead to the day when it says this: "People shall enter the caves of the rocks and the holes of the ground from before the terror of the Lord, and from the splendor of his majesty when he rises to terrify the earth." If you've got absolute holiness and absolute power, that is a terrifying combination if you're a sinful person. How do you see yourself? Do you see yourself as basically a pretty good person? Do you think, well, I'm not perfect, but then no one is, and I'm certainly better than him over there? If so, what you need is to see God as he really is. Because only then will you see yourself as you really are. On holiday in Sweden recently, our bedroom faces east. And the sun comes up at about sort of 4 a.m. At this time of year, or when we were out there. So we cover the bedroom windows with blackout fabric. And at night, the blackout fabric looks the real deal and looks absolutely fantastic and perfect. But at 4 a.m. when the sun comes up, I can tell you that the tiniest little hole looks like a torchlight as you've got the sun piercing through it and blazing through it. Just the tiniest little hole is shown up. And so, if you like, I may think of myself as being pretty good until I hold myself up to the blazing purity of God. And then I suddenly see how full of holes I really am. And then I stop comparing myself with other people and I start to say instead, "Woe is me, woe is me." It's really striking that the first five chapters of Isaiah The prophet is denouncing the sins of the people. So, for example, in chapter 5, Isaiah repeatedly says, "Woe to those who do this, and woe to those who do that." I counted 6 times. I put the verse references on your sheet at the bottom. And without a doubt, as God's prophet, Isaiah would have been much better than the people. But in the presence of God, degrees of sin become irrelevant. And woe is them becomes woe is me. Now, can you relate to that personally? Is that your experience? Is that how you see yourself? Woe is me. Or is your attitude rather, woe is them? Or, you know, God is lucky to have me on his team. If I compare myself to other people, I may think I'm doing pretty well. And I'll be tempted to become proud and to become very judgmental of other people. But once I see God as he is, high and lifted up in his majestic holiness, all these delusions about myself are blown away. And I see myself instead as the sinner that I really am. Lost, ruined, without hope. Tozer's classic book, The Knowledge of the Holy, begins with this line. What comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. What a line to open a book with. What comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. And this is one reason why. Because if I don't see God as he is, I won't see myself as I am. And if I don't see myself as I am, I won't see my need of God's grace, of the cross. Woe is me, Isaiah cried. Look how God responds. Verse 6. Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth, and he said, Behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away, and your sin atoned for. The altar in the temple was the place of sacrifice. So this coal taken from the altar symbolized that a sacrifice had been made. Isaiah had confessed that he was a man of unclean lips. And now one of the seraphim takes a burning coal from the altar, the place of sacrifice, and he touches his unclean lips with it. And in that one symbolic act, Isaiah was cleansed from sin. The seraphim declares, Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for. What wonderful words for Isaiah to hear, and indeed for anyone to hear. Your guilt is taken away. Not just your feeling of guilt, but yeah, that as well, but your objective guilt, before your actual guilt before a holy God is taken away. And your sin is atoned for. Atonement means that the debt of sin is covered, paid. Divine justice has been satisfied through this sacrifice. So in an instant, Isaiah was cleansed. He wasn't cleansed by his efforts, but purely by God's grace. Isaiah himself contributed nothing. It was all of God. Notice what Isaiah didn't say. So Isaiah didn't say, well, yeah, you know, I am unclean, but just wait, you know, I'll try harder. I can do better than this. Give me a chance. You know, I'll clean my act up. Didn't say that. He just received God's grace through this sacrifice. And of course, this sacrifice, as all the Old Testament sacrifices do, foreshadows the ultimate sacrifice of Christ on the cross. And so as we accept Christ's death for us, we hear these same words that Isaiah heard. Your guilt is taken away. Your guilt is taken away. And your sin is atoned for. Now, is that your experience? Has your guilt, do you know that your guilt has been taken away and that your sin has been atoned for through the cross? If not, it could be. Do you see God as he is now? Do you see yourself as you are, a sinner before him? Will you accept this grace of God which is being held out to you through the death of Christ for you? You could do that even today before you leave the barge. If you have done that, the key point to grasp is this is the basis on which we must continue to relate to God day by day. So this is the only basis on which we can ever stand before God. And that is why as believers we mustn't drift away from the cross. So we must really beware starting to think things like, And if you ever think that thoughts like this, I'm actually doing pretty well now as a Christian. Been a Christian a few years, making progress in godliness in some areas. Now I'm serving in ways I wasn't before. I actually know quite a bit now, know quite a few Bible verses, know my way around. And I'm doing a lot more than that person over there in terms of serving. We need to catch ourselves if we start thinking like that. And we need to repent of that sort of pride and delusion. And we need to see again what God is like and what we are like. Because even if you're Billy Graham, and I don't think he's here today, but even if you are Billy Graham and you've preached to millions of people, and even if tens of thousands of people have been saved through you, you stand before God today, a condemned sinner, whose only hope is God's grace. What Isaiah experienced needs to be, in a sense, our daily experience, that each new day I see again what God is like, and I see again what I am like, and I confess myself a lost sinner, and I receive afresh His grace, and I know my sin to be atoned for. Someone said this, they said, Isaiah was right. We are moral wrecks, and only by the grace of God are we daily preserved from total self-destruction. Now, as recipients of God's grace, then we are in a position to be used by God. And that's how this passage that was read to us ends. So verse 8 says, And I heard the voice of the Lord. So the Lord speaking for the first time here. I heard the voice of the Lord saying, Whom shall I send? And who will go for us? And then I said, Here am I. Send me. Isn't it wonderful? Cleansed by God's grace. The prophet now offers himself gladly, willingly in God's service. And the point was that what happened to Isaiah could happen to the rest of the people back then and can happen for us today. So notice how woe is me leads to here am I, send me. Here am I, send me. That is the difference God's grace makes. That if I know God's grace to me, I want to serve. If I know God's grace to me, I'll say, Lord, what can I do for you? How can I serve? If there is a need in the church family, I'll say, here am I, send me. If there's someone who needs to hear the gospel, I'll say, here am I, send me. That is the effect of God's grace. But if I haven't experienced God's grace, trying to serve God is actually pointless. It's getting things the wrong way round. And if I try to serve God, if I've not received His grace, it will be a wearisome business, and it will actually just make me feel proud. An older couple popped onto the barge on Thursday. They were just been at the museum and came in looking around and so on. And in the course of the conversation, we'd talked a bit about church. I asked them how long they'd been Christians. And the man said to me, so standing up very tall, he said to me, put it this way, I'm a church warden. And I said, that doesn't mean anything. You can be a vicar and it doesn't mean to say you've received God's grace. And we had a nice conversation, by the way. But, you know, I could be doing all sorts of things at church, but without having experienced God's grace for myself. But if we have received God's grace, then serving God is the natural consequence. We'll say, here am I, send me. But as we serve, we need to make sure we keep relying on God's grace. We keep close to the cross. Because otherwise our service will go bad on us and it'll become a burden and it will feed our pride. So why do we need the cross? Well, we won't see the need for it unless we see these two things clearly. Firstly, what God is like. And secondly, in the light of that, what I am like. And those, if you like, are the two lenses which need to be in our spectacles if we're going to see why we need the cross. And why we need it as much today as we ever did. So a couple of quotes I put on the back of your sheet there, which I found helpful. John Calvin begins his Institutes, so his monumental theology of the Christian faith, with these words at the bottom on the back of your sheet. He says, nearly all the wisdom we possess, that is to say, true and sound wisdom, consists of two parts, the knowledge of God and of ourselves. He goes on, man never achieves a clear knowledge of himself unless he has first looked upon God's face. For we always seem to ourselves righteous and upright and wise and holy. This pride is innate in all of us. Unless by clear proofs we stand convinced of our own unrighteousness, foulness, folly, and impurity. Or as the great English Puritan John Owen put it a century later, he said, there are two things that are suited to humble the souls of men, and they are first, a due consideration of God, and then of ourselves. Of God, in his greatness, glory, holiness, power, majesty, and authority, of ourselves in our mean, abject, and sinful condition. But with those two things clear, we will see that the cross of Jesus is, and was, and always will be, our biggest need. Next time we're going to explore what actually happened on the cross, but for now we're going to pause and have a minute of quiet, a chance to reflect on what we've been studying together, and to pray in the quiet. And then when the music starts, we're going to stand and sing a song in which we give thanks to the Lord for his love for us on the cross, and we give thanks for the man upon a cross with my sin upon his shoulders.